Somewhere, there's this myth that to be happy or succeed, you have to get rid of all negative people in your life. We hear things like, if someone doesn't support your dream, dump them as a friend. Your spouse doesn't cheer you on and meet your every need, get a divorce. The kids at school don't like your son, change schools. This is half-baked advice. Learning to live with people who are different from you and who challenge you is just part of becoming a mature and resilient adult. Cutting people out of your life just because they're not a bright and shiny ray of light all day, every day, will only result in you alone on an island talking to coconuts, okay? Everyone has bad days. Everyone struggles in life. And not everyone needs to cheer you on every step of the way. We need to accept that and not bail on everyone who isn't in a cheery mood all the time. Your friends, family, and coworkers are going to have a lot of bad days. And a lot of their attitude toward you has nothing to do with you. They're in their own world and going through difficulties. Most people will have their lives affected by a mental illness. Most of your friends will come and go in your life. This idea of just swiping people out of our lives isn't mature or reasonable. Sometimes love equals compassion and patience. Build what you need. Make a conscious effort to surround yourself with positive, nourishing, and uplifting people. People who believe in you, encourage you to go after your dreams, and applaud your victories. Jack Canfield. Still, you don't need to spend extraordinary amounts of time or give tremendous mindshare to negative people. People on a path of purpose don't have a lot of time for drama. So here's what I advise. Instead of getting rid of all the negative people in your life, especially if they are family, friends, loyal peers, or those who are just in need, spend more time, A, hanging with your positive and successful peers, and B, building a new positive peer group. You can give your time to the drama and conflict of telling people they aren't what you want or need in life, or you can use that same time to build a new circle. Tear down relationships or build new ones. I'd focus on building. I also want to address the excuse I hear all the time, especially from younger people, that I have no access to successful people. That's almost always an unexplored personal belief, not a reality. In fact, in a globally connected world, it's a pretty thin argument to say you don't have access to somebody somewhere who you can learn from, collaborate with, work for, or follow to advance your life. The real question isn't whether they exist, it's whether you're willing to do the work to find them, contact them, hound them, or work hard enough to rise until you get into their orbit. How do you do that? Here's my go-to list for helping someone get around a more successful peer group. Number one, add one more awesome friend. To make a difference in your life, you don't need dozens of new friends. You need one more positive person who brings out the best in you. So find your most positive and successful friend and ask him or her to bring one or two of his or her friends to your next night out. Then start hanging with them a little more often, just a half hour more per week. One more positive person leads you one more step toward the good life. Number two, volunteer. This is always my first move in working with people who feel surrounded by negative people. Volunteers are spirited, positive people. They are givers. You want to be around that spirit of service for your own personal and spiritual development anyway. You also want to be around volunteers because they tend to be more educated and successful people. People with higher levels of education are more likely to volunteer than those with less education. In the United States, almost 40% of those over the age of 25 who have a bachelor's degree or higher volunteer. That compares with 26.5% for those with some college or an associate's degree, 15.6% of high school graduates, and only 8.1% of those with less than a high school diploma. Often, the people who staff nonprofit organizations, especially at the board and committee levels, are the richest people in a community. But volunteering isn't just about getting around richer or more educated people. It's about serving others and developing the kind of empathy and spirit of service required to deal with all your relationships in life. If you have a negative person who keeps getting under your skin, the perspective you gain about the world through volunteering might help you chill out. To find great volunteer opportunities in your hometown, start by asking your friends. You'd be surprised how many already volunteer. Also, look up your town's name and volunteer, and you'll see plenty of options. And do it this week. When you meet more people who strive to make a big difference in the world, it makes a big difference in yours. Number 3, play sports. Join the intramural league. Visit that racquetball club. Get that golf membership. Hit the park and join more pickup games. Being in competitive situations teaches you to pay more attention to your own performance, and as we've learned, self-evaluation of performance promotes increased performance. Competition can bring out the best in us when we view the process of competing as a striving for excellence, personal bests, and team contributions. It's only bad or maladaptive performance when all you care about is rank, outcome, or smashing the competition. Number 4, seek mentorship. I tell high performers to have one or two lifelong mentors. Older, wiser, highly respected, successful people. I want you to call them once per month. I also want you to have one new domain mentor every 3 years. This means someone who has precisely the expertise you need to succeed in your field. You should also call that person every month. These two mentors, one for life and another for specific domain expertise, will give you extraordinary perspective. To find mentors, start again with your friends and family. Ask, who do I know who has great wisdom and influence, who I might be able to learn from? You might find a mentor at your workplace or by doing the actions above, say volunteering or playing sports. You can also type my name and how to find a mentor into YouTube and watch my video for more ideas. Number 5, earn it. You want to get around more successful people? Then earn your way into that party by becoming exceptional at what you do. Work hard. Practice the high-performance habits. Never give up. Add a tremendous amount of value and stay on the path to mastery. When you become supremely skilled and successful at what you do, doors will open and you'll meet more and more extraordinary people. Imagine how much better your life would be if you got better people into your social network. And no, I don't mean your Facebook group. I mean real people with real pulses who you actually see, call, work with, hang out with, exercise with, have fun adventures with. Choose to surround yourself with people who bring joy and growth into your life and are secure enough in themselves to be real and solid whether you shine or struggle. Bring your squad and their standards up. You'll become a more extraordinary person by having more extraordinary people around you. Performance prompts. Number 1. The most positive people in my life who I should hang out with more include. Number 2. To add to the number of high performers in my network, I should. Number 3. Some new routines or get-togethers I could create to bring together the positive and supportive people in my life include. No other choice. First, say to yourself what you would be, and then do what you have to do. Epictetus. We all know someone who wasn't the smartest kid in the class, who seemed unprepared for life, who seemed to have more weaknesses than strengths, and who somehow went on to surprise everyone with their success. Asked how they rose above others who were more privileged or qualified than they, such people often say, I was hungry. I had to succeed. There was no other choice. They had necessity. The flip side is how many people without this mentality never reach their full powers. No necessity, no drive, no fulfillment of their potential. As with all high-performance habits, you have to be deliberate about raising your level of necessity. You must consistently think it through. Have I associated the important activities of my day with my identity and my sense of obligation? Why is chasing this dream so important to me? Why must I do this? When must I do it? How can I get around more amazing people who up my game and help me serve at the next level? These questions, frequently revisited, can be the prompts for an entirely new level of commitment and drive. You are only as strong and extraordinary as you give yourself reason to be. So determine your musts, my friend. Make them real. Feel them in your gut, because the world needs you to show up now. Section 2, Social Habits. On page 171 of High Performance Habits is the Section 2 opener, and there is a diagram there of two circles joined together, just like at the beginning of the book, the personal habits on the left, the social habits on the right. This section focuses on the social habits, so highlighted here are the next three of the high performance habits: increase productivity, develop influence, and demonstrate courage. high-performance habit number 4, increase productivity. Don't think about making art. Just get it done. Let everyone else decide if it's good or bad, whether they love it or hate it. While they are deciding, make even more art. Andy Warhol. This chapter has 3 practices. Increase the outputs that matter. Chart your 5 moves. Get insanely good at key skills. It's just not happening fast enough. Athena, a school administrator, says this in a defeated tone. We're in her office, discussing her goals and how productive she feels that her career has been. Thick binders are crammed into the shelves behind her. There's a tiny window next to her desk. No pictures adorn the white walls, which seem yellowed with time. I can't help but feel that this office, no, make it the entire admin building, was built in the 1970s and never painted it again. Athena has worked in this room for 14 years. I'm busier now than I've ever been in my whole career. There's a lot of urgency right now because they're about to close 2 of my schools. I barely leave this office, even for lunch. She points at 2 takeout boxes on the windowsill. I have meetings all day with teachers, principals, parents, community leaders. In between, I try to cram an email. I'm up late every night reviewing proposals. I've worked around the clock for what feels like 4 years. I don't feel like I'm making enough progress, even though I'm ticking off one thing after another. I decide to ask a question that type A's dread when discussing their productivity. Are you happy? Athena scowls. I don't want to sound unhappy, Brendan. It's not like I'm saying my life is awful or my career sucks. I'm just not as effective as I want to be or everyone needs me to be. That's why we asked you here to focus on being more effective. I found that when you're talking with really busy people, they usually leave the topic of happiness quickly. Okay, so Athena, are you effectively happy? She laughs. Happy enough, I guess. It's not like every day is a dream, but I do love what I'm doing. It's just, I think there must be a better way. A better way than what? Than killing myself, working this hard to get what feels like nowhere. I want to retire after 20 years, but that's 6 years from now. I don't even know if I can make it another 2 at this pace. And even if I do, I'm scared I'll retire and look back and think, what was it all for? What did I really accomplish? What do you think it's all for? Oh, the schools, for sure. I'm clear about that. That's why I started this career. I know if I can make the schools in my community healthy, I can make generations of kids have better lives. Okay. Sounds like a wonderful mission. You say you might wonder what you really accomplished. What do you hope that to be? I hope to have accomplished some more big projects that these schools can benefit from for generations. But I can't imagine how I can get there. I'm already trying so hard just to maintain. I'm putting in the hours, but I haven't advanced as fast as I thought I would. I'm not making the difference I had hoped because my projects move too slow. My work-life balance is a mess. It's just that I feel like I'm always pushing and pushing and juggling and juggling. I'm always having to reinvent the wheel with every project. I'm always fighting fires and scrambling to achieve anything that lasts. She trails off and looks at the blank yellowed wall beside her. It's like no matter what I do, I'm not getting these big projects accomplished, and I worry I'm not approaching them right. No matter what I do, it's just... I feel an intense energy coming from her. A lump has grown in my throat. I know where this is going. It hurts to see someone with vision caged here in this office. It's just what? Everything I do, it's just never... She blinks back tears. Enough. One of the worst feelings in the world is to be incredibly busy, but feel that you're not making any progress. You're fighting the good fight, but your approach is wrecking your health or compromising your well-being. Projects seem to take forever. Progress seems too slow. Happiness is always a distant horizon never reached. Athena felt that. Most of us have at some point. It was hard watching Athena experience these feelings because from the outside she seemed like a one-woman SWAT team. She finished each day with a lot of to-dos crossed off her list. What she had yet to learn was that not only was balance possible, but so was increased progress. She also had to discover that sometimes all that busy work isn't your life's work. Sometimes being effective isn't enough because achievement can be hollow if it goes out of sync with who you are, what you really want to be doing, what you're actually capable of. She had to learn the difference between just getting things done and reaching high performance productivity. High performers have a very deliberate approach in planning their days, projects, and tasks compared to underperformers. Like most productive people, high performers score well on statements such as, I'm good at setting priorities and working on what's important, and I stay focused and avoid distractions and temptations. The stronger the agreement with such statements, the greater the overall high performance score. The difference is that when they compare themselves to their peers, high performers are more productive and yet also happier, less stressed, and more rewarded over the long term. The happiness finding is especially relevant since many people believe they can't possibly do more without compromising their well-being or sense of balance. But that's just not true. High performers have found a way to produce more, but also eat healthier, work out more, and still feel a greater love for taking on new challenges than their peers do. And they don't just get more busy work done in the sense that they slop things together. High performers complete more activities and report being more excellence-driven than their peers. My interviews with many high performers and their peers over the past decade confirm their statements. None of this is because high performers are superhuman or over-caffeinated, nor is it because of the feel-good ideals we're often sold today to become more productive, believing that you give more than your peers or that you are making a difference. Can certainly increase your sense of motivation and satisfaction. But again, those things don't always lead to increased productivity. Just because you're a giver doesn't mean you're good at setting priorities or avoiding distractions. Givers might feel a lot of heart, but they don't always finish what they start. So how is it that high performers produce more but also maintain well-being and balance? It's because they have many of the deliberate habits you'll learn in this chapter. To get the most out of this chapter, it's important that you set aside any preconceived notions about work-life balance or whether seeking tangible achievements in your life is a worthy goal. Stay open-minded because mastering this habit can have far-reaching consequences into every aspect of your life, especially in how you feel about yourself and the world in general. Our research found that if you feel you are more productive, you are statistically more likely to feel happier, more successful, and more confident. You're also more likely to take better care of yourself, get promoted more often, and earn more than people who feel less productive. These are not my opinions. They are important and measurable life outcomes that we found in multiple surveys and studies. In my coaching experience, it's clear that high performers are also the most valued and highly paid people in an organization. Organizations want high-performance leaders because they are focused, manage tasks well, and succeed more often in taking projects through to completion. They get overwhelmed less, and they work on their goals longer with a greater sense of joy and camaraderie than others experience. Clearly, there is power in mastering this area of your life. Let's examine the basics, then move on to the advanced habits. Productivity basics. The day is always his who works with serenity and great aims. Ralph Waldo Emerson. The fundamentals of becoming more productive are setting goals and maintaining energy and focus. No goals, no focus, no energy, and you're dead in the water. Productivity starts with goals. When you have clear and challenging goals, you tend to be more focused and engaged, which leads to a greater sense of flow and enjoyment in what you're doing. Greater enjoyment gives you that intrinsic motivation that has been correlated with greater productivity in both quantity and quality of output. The same goes for teams. Groups that have clear and challenging goals almost always outperform those without explicit goals. Research consistently shows that group goals inspire people to work more quickly and for longer periods, pay more attention to the tasks that matter, become less distracted, and increase their overall effort. Energy is another huge factor in determining productivity. As we discussed in Chapter 3, almost everything you do to take good care of yourself matters in increasing your high performance. Good sleep, nutrition, and exercise are huge enhancers of productivity. And not just your productivity, the productive output of entire economies can be tied, for example, to their citizens' nutrition habits. You'll recall that capital E energy wasn't just about sleep, nutrition, and exercise, but also about positive emotions. It's an undisputed fact that happier people are more productive. In fact, one meta-analysis of over 275,000 people across more than 200 studies found that happy people aren't just more productive, they also receive higher evaluations for quality of work, dependability, and creativity. Another study found that students who were more cheerful in college were more financially successful than their peers over a decade after graduation. Even that old advice of smile and you'll get more done plays true. One study found that just watching a comedy clip to bring some joy into your life before doing serious work can increase productivity. Finally, if you're going to be productive, you've got to maintain focus. This isn't easy in the modern era. Information overwhelm, distractions, and interruptions cause dire consequences in both our health and our productivity. Information overload causes demoralization and lower work quality. Dealing with an endless stream of inputs or having to spend a large chunk of our day poring over data or searching for it makes us miserable. That's why we have the term analysis paralysis. We're paralyzed by too much data and too much time spent gathering and analyzing that data. This is just one reason why you should never check your email first thing in the morning. That big flood of emails causes overwhelm and reactivity, not the emotion or mindset you want to frame your day with. Instead, try some of the activities we discussed in the energy chapter. Distraction is another downer. One study found that distraction lowers productivity by 20%. It's even worse if we're working on challenging mental tasks. Distractions then can slow our thinking by almost half. Several studies have shown that multitasking itself is a distraction. It is incompatible with the peak concentration states that are associated with high performance and quality work. When people multitask, they cannot focus fully on the task at hand because their brain is still processing their last unfinished task. The final big culprit is interruptions. Most people in larger organizations are interrupted several times during any given task, activity, or meeting. When they are, they have trouble focusing again and catching back up to what they were doing. They don't bounce back to their original effort, but instead turn to, on average, two other tasks or projects before reorienting themselves to the original effort. With my Fortune 50 clients, even the highest achieving, I've noticed that one significant interruption in the workday can throw off important and scheduled tasks by 2 to 3 hours. These facts should get you seriously disciplined about setting challenging goals and keeping your energy and focus on track. But that's hard work, and often those efforts are derailed by our assumptions that it's just not possible. Too many people say they can't set larger goals or maintain energy because their work-life balance would be upended. In fact, the conversation around work-life balance has become so absurd, I'd like to address it specifically before moving on to our habits. The work-life balance debate. One of the most common ways for the modern person to maintain self-deception is to keep busy all the time. Daniel Putnam. These days, many people have thrown in the towel on the concept of work-life balance, but not so fast. People can find balance in their lives, and to believe otherwise is a terribly disempowering and inaccurate assumption. Having trained literally millions of people on the topic of productivity, I've come to realize that those who don't think work-life balance is possible believe this because either A, they've never made a fully conscious, consistent effort to define, seek, and measure that balance, or B, they simply define work-life balance using an impossible-to-achieve standard. First, let's address the often-voiced idea that work-life balance is impossible. Calling any human endeavor impossible typically proves to be a naive conceit, and this is no exception. When someone says to me that work-life balance is impossible, I remind them that human beings have crossed oceans, summited the highest mountains, built skyscrapers, landed on the moon, and guided vehicles beyond the solar system. What we are capable of is remarkable, and what we will attempt is constrained only by our beliefs. And so I say to you that if you believe a better work-life balance is impossible, you've already lost the fight. I also remind many of my clients who have given up on this issue that they simply never tried as hard to find balance as they've tried in other efforts. They'll spend 10 months planning the achievement of a work project, but not a single day planning more balance in their upcoming week. If you won't focus as attentively on balancing your life as on achieving any other project, then you've settled the matter. In that case, don't point an accusing finger at the entire work-life balance conversation. Point the finger at the person looking at you from the mirror who simply refused to try. If we can keep an open mind in this discussion, we might realize that a major problem is the way we approach work-life balance in the first place. The great mistake most people make is to think of balance in terms of evenly distributed hours. They think they're supposed to spend equal time on work and quote-unquote life. Their expectation is a quantity expectation versus a quality expectation, and anytime we confuse the two, we get into trouble. Still, despite how many people feel they don't have balance in this regard, most, in fact, do. The vast majority of us spend 30% of our lives working, assuming a standard 40-hour work week, 30% sleeping, and 30% doing other stuff, such as hanging out with the family, pursuing hobbies or health, handling life's basic needs. Indeed, most people have a lot more time off and more time with their families than they think. It's just that they're not intentional about that time, and hence don't enjoy that time enough. It's ironic that the average American who watches 4 to 5 hours of television per day says they have no time and no balance. To be fair, a lot of people do work a lot more than 40 hours per week, and in the always connected culture we live in today, where a response is expected at all hours of the day and night, it can feel as though balance is gone. That's why I think there's a better approach to thinking about work-life balance. Instead of trying to balance hours, try to balance happiness or progress in your major life arenas. Let me elaborate. When most people feel that they're out of balance, it's because one area of their life became more intense, important, and time-consuming than the others. They got so obsessed about work that they let their health or their marriage slide, or they got so focused on a family issue that their work suffered. The solution is to keep perspective in life by keeping an eye on the quality or progress of the major life arenas. A simple weekly review of what we're after in the major areas of our life helps us rebalance or at least plan for more balance. I found that it's useful to organize life into 10 distinct categories: health, family, friends, intimate relationship, whether partner or marriage, mission and work, finances, adventure, hobby, spirituality, and emotion. When I'm working with clients, I often make them rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10 and also write their goals in each of these 10 arenas every Sunday night. Most of them have never done that before, but doesn't it stand to reason that only from measuring something in the first place can we determine whether it's in balance? If you aren't consistently measuring the major arenas of your life, then you couldn't possibly know what the balance you seek is or is not. This activity is really just a simple check-in. I know, but you'd be surprised how powerful it is. I once gave an executive team of 16 people this weekly activity, and in just 6 weeks, they reported dramatic increases in their sense of well-being and work-life balance. Admittedly, this was a small and informal study, but nonetheless, we saw double-digit increases when nothing changed in their work or personal lives except taking time each week to assess their 10 life arenas. Sometimes, just having a look at the larger picture can help us feel more in control, adjust course as needed, and yes, find more balance. That was what Athena, the school administrator at the beginning of this chapter, so desperately needed. That day in her office, I asked her to rate herself in the 10 arenas. To her surprise, she hadn't even thought about many aspects of life outside of work for years. Who's to blame in that situation? Is it her boss's fault? The society we live in? No. If we're honest, our lack of attention to the important areas of our life is no one's fault but our own. What Athena discovered was that she needed a weekly ritual to assess where she was and what balance could even mean to her. The other distinction generally missed about work-life balance is that it's not so much about evenly distributed hours as about feelings. It's not about the hours you spend, but about the harmony you feel. Often, people simply feel unhappy with or disconnected from their work. If you don't like your work and you have to spend a lot of time doing it, then of course you feel as though your life is out of balance. You would recognize that your busy work isn't your life's work, and that dissonance would cause you mental distress. That's why it's important to live in harmony with what you truly desire and to do the activities in the chapter on clarity. You'll always feel out of balance if you're doing work that you don't find engaging and meaningful. Other times, people are engaged and enjoying their work, but they're fried from too much stress and too many hours on the job. There's a fine line between busy and burned out. And when you cross it, no matter how great your life is outside work, you will feel out of balance. Burnout in one area of life easily scorches others. So what can we do? In the chapter on energy, we covered a lot of the basics. Transition better, release tension, get more sleep, exercise more, eat better. The good news is that if burnout is often just a feeling of fatigue, there's also a simpler fix. If we can just give you a short mental and physical refresh or reset every hour, then you can dramatically improve how you feel and you'll sense a significant improvement in your work-life balance. This means that for most people, they didn't need to quit their job because of work-life balance problems. They just needed to change what they did on the job so that they felt more energetically balanced. Happily, that's easier than you may think. Take a break. There is virtue in work and there is virtue in rest. Use both and overlook neither. Alan Cohen. Your brain also needs more downtime than you probably think to process information, recover, and deal with life so that you can be more productive. That's why for optimal productivity, you should not only take longer breaks, claim your vacation time, but also give yourself intermittent breaks throughout the day. Researchers have long known that taking breaks at work leads to positive emotions and greater productivity. For example, simple acts such as taking a lunch break away from your desk each day can significantly increase your performance at work. Taking a short break to get outside to a nearby park for just a few minutes can give you cognitive benefits so that you return to work restored and with greater focus. If you're unwilling to move away from the desk, simply standing up intermittently at your desk to work can increase productivity by 45% compared to sitting all day. Some researchers have argued that we need these breaks because we have limited cognitive resources and we use up our psychological bandwidth or self-control. While this theory has been questioned, perhaps we don't run out of self-control and focus at all, but rather just lose motivation. One thing is certain. Working straight through the day with no breaks makes people unhappy and less productive. We've all sat at our desk and noticed our attention flagging, even when we like our work. We've all felt tired, even doing work we love. We've all run out of ideas, even when our butt is on the line to solve a problem. In all these instances, that's your mind telling you that you need a break. We've all noticed, too, that simple things such as a chat at the cooler, a bathroom break, or letting our mind wander for a few minutes after lunch often refreshes us. It's self-evident that our minds need rest to restore neurochemicals and increase our future attention. The science is so conclusive on this that most organizational experts recommend brief breaks away from the desk at least every 90 to 120 minutes to increase employee satisfaction and performance. But my research, as well as others, has shown that the number should be cut in half. If you want to feel more energized, creative, and effective at work, and still leave work with enough oomph for the life part, the ideal breakpoint is to stop your work and give your mind and body a break every 45 to 60 minutes. This means you shouldn't work longer at any one thing without a mental and physical break for more than an hour tops. A break of just 2 to 5 minutes every hour can help you feel much more mentally alert and energized for your work and life overall. For example, if you're going to work on email or a presentation for 2 hours, I recommend you get up from your chair at 50 minutes in, then take a fast stroll around the office, grab some water, come back to your chair, and do a 60-second transition meditation. As a reminder from the chapter on energy, a transition meditation means you simply close your eyes, focus on deep breathing, repeat to yourself a mantra such as release, and then set an intention for the next activity. If you want extra credit, also ask the desk trigger question from the previous chapter on necessity. Who needs me on my A game right now the most? Notice what's not included during these breaks. Checking email, texts, or social media. Checking in is the exact opposite of our goal here. Checking out so we can recharge. Achievers often brush off this advice because they just want to sit and power through hours of activity at their computer or in meetings. But that's exactly why they are feeling so wiped out in their home life and thus report a terrible work-life balance. Remember, hours at home versus at work is not the issue. It's more about their feelings and overall sense of energy. Powering through is just bad advice. Studies of the world's top performers in dozens of fields found that they don't necessarily practice or work longer than others. It's that they are more effective in those practice sessions or simply have more sessions, not longer ones. Putting in longer hours is almost always the wrong answer if you want to reach balance, happiness, or sustained high performance. It's counterintuitive, but it is true. By slowing down or taking a break once in a while, you work faster, leaving more time for other areas of life. For my clients, this 45 to 60 minute break becomes a way of life. It's a strict protocol in the first months working together. I tell them, if your butt lands in a chair, then set a 50-minute timer on your phone or computer. At 50 minutes, no matter what you're working on, stand up, move, breathe, set an intention, and then return to your work. If you want the 50-minute timer I give them, just visit highperformancehabits.com/tools. The stand-up part of my advice is important. You can't just close your eyes and meditate at your desk. You need to give your body a break from the posture you've been holding while sitting. So get up and move around a bit and do some basic stretching. If all you did was stand up every hour, close your eyes, and bounce in place while taking 10 deep, long breaths, you'd feel a total renewal of focus and productivity in your life. No matter where I'm sitting, on a plane, in a cafe, at work, in a meeting, on the couch, I get up every 50 minutes. I do a short 2-minute physical routine of calisthenics, qigong, and yoga paired with deep breathing. This 50-minute rule is something I never break, even when I'm in a meeting with other people. I often make them stand and do an energizer with me, or I excuse myself and go and find a place to refresh for 2 to 3 minutes. Those short, few-minute breaks buy me hours of added focus and effectiveness each day. If you follow the steps outlined in this chapter, you can find greater work-life balance. So do not fear becoming more productive or seeking higher achievement. Just be sure to gauge your work-life balance every week by rating yourself in the 10 areas of your life and having goals in each. Then take a 2 to 3 minute break every 45 to 60 minutes of your day. That's the basics. Now, let's get to the advanced practices for productivity. Practice 1. Increase the outputs that matter. Nothing is less productive than to make more efficient what should not be done at all. Peter Drucker. If you want to become extraordinary, you need to figure out the productive outputs that matter in your field or industry. Eminent scientists produce more important papers than their less known or less effective counterparts. Mozart and Beethoven became great not only by their genius, but also through their productive output. The same goes for Bob Dylan, Louis Armstrong, the Beatles. In its highest performing years, Apple launched products that were hit after hit. Babe Ruth took more swings than his contemporaries, just as Michael Jordan took a lot more shots and Tom Brady threw a lot more passes. Seth Godin cranks out blogs, Malcolm Gladwell cranks out books and articles, Casey Neistat keeps uploading those YouTube videos, Chanel keeps the fresh designs coming, and Beyonce keeps dropping great albums. High performers have mastered the art of prolific quality output, what we call PQO. They produce more high-quality output than their peers over the long term, and that is how they became more effective, better known, more remembered. They aim their attention and consistent efforts toward PQO and minimize any distractions, including opportunities, that would steal them away from their craft. This point seems almost universally lost in a world where people spend over 28% of their workweek managing email and another 20% just looking for information. People spend eons of time on worthless activities, say, creating folders and organizing their email, even though these have nothing to do with real productivity. Yes, sorry, your elaborate email folders aren't helping you. A 2011 study of 85,000 actions by 345 email users found that people who create complex folders are less efficient in finding what they need than those who simply use search or threading. I bring up email because achievers almost universally blame it for their poor productivity. But email, per se is not the problem. The real culprit is our very orientation to work itself. Real work isn't replying to everyone's false emergencies, shuffling paper, deleting junk emails, posturing to look good, or attending meetings. Real work is producing quality output that matters. Part of your job is to figure out what relevant PQO means to you. For the blogger, it might mean more frequent and better content. For the cupcake store owner, it might be discerning the two best-selling flavors and expanding distribution on just those two flavors. The parent may choose to increase the frequency of free time and great experiences with the kids. The sales rep might go after more meetings with qualified prospects. The graphic designer might pump out more great images. For the academic, it might be the quality of the curriculum and classes or the number of published papers or books. Figuring out what you are supposed to produce and learning the priorities in the creation, quality, and frequency of that output is one of the greatest breakthroughs you can have in your career. Look back to almost any business icon and you see a turning point in their career and wealth, which came about when they discovered their PQO. For Steve Jobs, it was dumping a bunch of products from Apple's list so he could focus on massively scaling fewer products, which would change the world. For Walt Disney, it was ramping up production of movies. In the modern digital era, some of the greatest success stories are those who simply enabled others to share more original and prolific content. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, for example. Wherever PQO is found, it seems that breakthroughs in wealth follow. I left a corporate consulting job in 2006 because I couldn't find fulfillment in the outputs that were being rewarded. When I looked to the partners at my old employer, the PQO was basically how many big clients they signed per year. Though a lot of wonderful things came with that, the ability to do deals, change things, I just didn't connect with the idea of dedicating my life to a career built on deals. For a guy at my lowly level, the informal culture supported a PQO of project hopping, getting on as many projects as we could so that we gain perspective, expand our network, and get paid for extra travel. Again, there were other benefits to all this, but I just didn't connect. Very little of the end game at that job resonated with me. One of the great realizations of life can come from discovering that the outputs you are being compensated for are not exciting or fulfilling. When that realization comes, it's time to honor that truth and make a change. I chose to quit and begin my career as a writer, speaker, and online trainer. I saw the outputs of those efforts, creating content for inspiring and empowering others, as something that would be meaningful to me. The issue was, I had no idea how to start or what specifically to do. Like a lot of people new to the expert industry, I thought I had to figure out the writing industry, the speaking industry, the online training industry. I made the mistake of going to dozens of conferences to try to figure out each of the industries without realizing that they all were the same career of being a thought leader and had similar outputs that mattered most. For almost a year, casting about with no clarity on which outputs really mattered, I was a mess. I was trying to write articles for magazines and blogs, begging people to let me speak to their groups and hoping to get paid, spinning my wheels, learning 100 online marketing ideas. Then one day, sitting in a cafe, I realized I'd spent all day, quote unquote, working, but had nothing really to show for it. I thought, not one thing I've done today is going to advance my career or be remembered by me or anyone else 10 years from now. I still remember that conversation in my head. If you're honest with yourself, you want to create things that matter. You want to know that a good day's work produces something worthwhile, something that will be part of your important contributions to others and the world, something that shows you care about your craft. Of course, I realized that not every day would be a magical, perfect day where every task I did was earth-shaking, monumental. We all have activities that have to get done that don't make us feel like legends. Taking out the trash isn't adding to your body of great works, but it has to get done. What changed the trajectory of my career that day was deciding, on a single page, what my PQOs would be. If I was going to be a real writer, then my productive output needed to become books. This audiobook you're listening to, it's the sixth I've published since that day. Two more unreleased manuscripts are waiting in my drawer. This says nothing of the thousands of emails, blog articles, sales letters, and social media posts I've written. But my main effort is books. Wayne Dyer, a mentor and dearly missed friend, wrote and published more than 30 books. I'm just a beginner, but I know my PQO, and that gives me what Wayne would have called the power of intention. I decided that if I was going to be a professional speaker, my PQO would be the number of paid speaking gigs at a certain booking fee. I stopped all wasteful conversations asking people to give me a chance to speak and started building marketing materials and videos like those of other speakers who were getting booked at the levels I wanted to reach. I knew that if I was going to be an online course trainer, a relatively new career back in 2006, then my PQO would be curriculum, training videos, and full online courses. As I shared in the chapter on clarity, I stopped trying to learn every new marketing technique that came along and put my full effort into creating and promoting online courses. The rest, as they say, is history. Nearly 2 million people have enrolled in my online courses or video series, and my free instructional videos about how to live a fully charged life have been viewed over 100 million times. If I hadn't figured out my PQO, I would never have had the blessing of reaching all these students. I would never have had been named one of the most successful online trainers in history by Oprah.com or to make Success Magazine's list of the top personal development influencers for so many years. Please know that I'm not sharing this to impress you, but I am sharing it to convey the tremendous power of deciding what your PQO is to be and going for it. The results in my career are not because I'm particularly special or talented. They happen because I honed the focus for the PQOs that mattered in my career and gave those outputs my obsessive attention and dedication continuously over the long term. I cannot emphasize the importance of this strategy. Whenever I have to help a client increase high performance, quickly discovering what output they should be creating is one of my go-to strategies. No matter what topic or type of deliverables they decide to get productive toward, I have them reorient their entire work schedule toward that endeavor. As quickly as possible, I want them spending 60% or more of their work week oriented to PQO. In my experience over this past decade, that 60% figure seems to be the sweet spot where real results start happening for a person's career. For most people, the other 40% ends up in such buckets as strategy, team management, and the everyday tasks of work or running a business. I spend 60% of my work week on writing, creating curriculum for online training, and filming videos. The other 40% goes to strategy, team management, industry relationships, and customer engagement, which includes social media and communicating with students. The 40% is really just the things that support or facilitate the 60%, the prolific quality output. Not everyone has my career, of course, and the golden proportion of 60-40 is not feasible for everyone. But the goal isn't to do what I do, it's to find your best allocation of time and stick to it the best you can. I'm tenaciously consistent about my 60-40, and whenever it drops below that, I know I'm not producing my best. If these time allocations sound extreme, please note that this is very different from the advice of those who tell you to go all in and give one of your passions 100% of your time. Such guidance is patently absurd anyway. We can't give 100% of our time to anything, certainly not if we're working with other people, caring for our families, or trying to make a big impact. There's always going to be a percentage of time we must give to working with or leading other people, managing and administering the details of our jobs, and yes, email. My point is you can't shirk those things, but you can and must strategize and maximize your time working on outputs that make your career important and influential. Why don't more people focus on producing prolific quality output, especially given that they still have the 40% allocation for dealing with the inevitable obligations of work? The most common excuses, is delusions a better word, are procrastination and perfectionism. Despite how familiar we are with blaming procrastination, it's not a real thing. Procrastination isn't a part of the human psyche. It's not even a personality trait. It's also not a result of poor time management skills that can easily be pointed at. Instead, researchers have found that procrastination is really a motivational problem. It's an issue that arises because you're not working on things that intrinsically matter to you. In rare cases, it can be about anxiety or fear of failure, but far more often it stems from working on things that don't excite you, engage you, or matter to you. That's why finding a PQO you can get behind is so important. If you love what you're creating or contributing in the world, you'll experience less procrastination. Whenever I tell people to create more output, inevitably I run into the perfectionists. They say things like, "Well, Brendan, I can't just put more stuff out there. I'm a perfectionist. I have to know that it's absolutely right and will be loved." Perfectionism, though, is just a delay logic fancied up to look respectable. The reason people don't finish more things isn't perfectionism. It's that they rarely even begin, or they get tangled up in doubt or distraction. If someone were a true perfectionist, they would at least have completed and released their work, since the very act of perfecting something comes only after it is completed, released, and then improved on. We could all find reasons why it's hard to be more productive. But rather than spending any more mental power there, let's just get to work. Let's remember what's most important. Let's focus. Let's produce real things that we're proud of. Let's be prolific and change the world. Performance prompts. Number one, the outputs that matter most to my career are... Number two, some things I could stop doing so I can focus more on PQO are... Number three, the percentage of my weekly time I will allocate to PQO is, and the ways I'll make that happen are. These performance prompts are on page 194 of High Performance Habits, the book, and you can also download them again at highperformancehabits.com/tools. Practice 2. Chart your 5 moves. I believe half the unhappiness in life comes from people being afraid to go straight at things. William Locke. Humans are masterful jugglers. We can manage several projects at the same time, achieve many tasks concurrently, carry on multiple levels of conversation, implicit and explicit, with several people at the dinner table. This strength serves all of us up to a point. Then it destroys us. Most people reach their first levels of success through their ability to multitask with excellence. The entrepreneur starting the cupcake shop plays every role necessary to succeed and chases every opportunity available to her. She's the person who orders inventory, the baker who makes the cupcakes, the cashier who takes the orders, the marketer who mails the coupons, the networker who wins friends in the neighborhood. She hustles in dozens of roles and takes on hundreds of tasks. At some point, she earns a profit. Over time, she succeeds. She might even hit high performance. But with success comes new opportunities. Soon, she's advising other startups. She's dabbling in other opportunities. She hasn't reached her primary goal of a world-class cupcake shop, but she's comfortable. She'll tell you that her cupcake business is still a priority, but dig into her calendar, and you can see that priority no longer equates to work. Look closer, and you'll see that most of her efforts are unaligned. She's busy, but she's not progressing with purpose. What should she do now to get back on track? She should simplify, strip things down to the essential parts, and favor deep work. Most importantly, she should get a plan. A lot of highly driven people think they don't need well-defined plans. They have talent, so they just want to get in the game, hustle, wing it, and see what happens. That might work when they're just starting out and everyone on the field around them is also uninformed. At that point, perhaps their innate, God-given talent can help them get ahead. But the advantage dies quickly. As soon as the other teams and players have actual experience and plans, they know the X's and O's, their routes and play calls, and you don't, you're toast. This is terribly difficult for high performers to hear. I can't tell you how many high performers lose their perch at the top because of the inevitable distraction that comes from unfocused efforts. I'm not talking about the lazy kind of distraction. High performers are making things happen, all right. But when they start making a lot of things happen with no unifying trajectory, they begin losing their power. Then they lose their passion. Then they're achieving a lot of little things, but no big, meaningful things. The issue is that some people simply got away with not planning for a long time. That's because you don't need much of a plan to figure out simple tasks. Simple tasks usually require obvious steps, few interaction points, and your own independent actions. But for complex tasks and goals, planning is vital because there are usually a variety of strategies that can help achieve a goal, and some are more effective or desirable than others. The bigger the goal, the more to manage and the more interaction points with other people. To become a high performer requires thinking more before acting. This doesn't necessarily mean you must have the entire path and every task figured out in advance. Often, long-term projects require you to set a plan as best you can, then figure things out on the fly. Still, research continues to show that when goals or projects are complex, planning always improves performance. Having a plan and working through it step by step is more important than you think. A plan focuses scattered thinking, and finishing each vital task on your list fires off dopamine in the brain, making you feel both rewarded and more motivated to continue. A plan not only increases your likelihood of completing an activity, but also increases your joy during the project and your available cognitive resources for the next goal. And so, after all that we've discussed about finding the area where you want to create prolific quality output, it is now time to plan. Think of the most ambitious dream you'd like to take on. Identify what you really want. Then ask yourself, if there were only 5 major moves to make that goal happen, what would they be? Think of each major move as a big bucket of activities, a project. These big 5 projects that move you toward achieving your dream can then be broken down into deliverables, deadlines, and activities. Once you're clear on these things, put them into your calendar, scheduling the bulk of your time into protected blocks during which you do nothing but make progress toward the activity that the specific block is dedicated to. So if I show up at your house and say, "Show me your calendar," I should readily see the major projects you are working toward. If I can't discern from your weekly and monthly calendar what major moves you are working toward, then you're not optimizing your time and you're at risk of getting sucked into a life of reaction and distraction. That, or you're just going to have to take years getting a result that others could do in months. High performers plan almost everything more than underperformers do, from workouts to learning, from meetings to vacation time. It's easy to get confused at this point, though, and become lost in tasks and over-planning. Lots of people will overcomplicate this. So let's pause here and remember that the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Know the big 5 moves that will take you to your goal. Break those moves down into tasks and deadlines, then put them in a calendar. If that's all you did and you made sure these moves aligned with your PQO, you'd be ahead of the game. Here's a rather public example that I'm amazed worked so well. Earlier, I shared with you my dream of becoming a writer. As you may recall, I was all over the place, writing things here and there, but getting no real progress until I identified my PQO as writing books. Once I knew I wanted to be prolific at writing books, I stopped other activities. Then I started exploring what the 5 major moves were to getting a book out. Specifically, I wanted to become a New York Times best-selling author. I wasn't after the accolade itself, but what it represented. Lots of people improving their lives. But there was a problem. I'd already written a book, and it didn't hit the bestseller list. I was demoralized and made the mistake of thinking the system was broken and didn't reward new authors. I wanted to blame a lot of people, but I had to face a tough truth. I hadn't planned well enough the first time. The entire process of writing and promoting a book was as haphazard as could be for a newbie. This time, I decided I wouldn't allow such unsystematic activities to seal the fate of my new book. I didn't just start writing tidbits throughout the day as I had for my previous book. I didn't follow my impulses to go to writers' conferences or read a lot of books about writing. I didn't try to do 100 things in 100 directions. I knew that would lead to exhaustion, frustration, and failure again. Instead, I interviewed several number one best-selling authors and deconstructed their major activities. I simply asked what 5 major moves made the most difference in moving your writing forward and landing your book on the big bestseller lists. You can do the same thing. find the successful people you want to emulate in some way and discover their five moves. What I learned wasn't what I expected. Best-selling authors